Good morning. Call to order the Subcommittee on Redistricting. Thank you, members, for juggling schedules on a Friday. I know there's a lot going on here. So, members, we are going to take up principles. Some people refer to this as criteria for that could ultimately be used as kind of a framework to measure and build our redistricting plans or maps. So principles. We've had we've touched on this a couple times as a subcommittee. Senator Rest introduced some language and has talked about some language a couple of our hearings already. What we have in front of us is ultimately two pieces here. We'll have a Senate File 1317, and we'll also have a Senate concurrent resolution, which is number 7. So let's take up the Senate File 1317 first.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Before we do that,
yes,
I do want to object to the hearing of the concurrent resolution for which the public and minority members were only given 25 minutes or so notice that it was going to come up today under Rule 12.3.
And Senator Rest, let's pursue that a little bit. There may have been a noticing issue, and I personally apologize for that. My intent is that the resolution would be almost exactly the same language that is in the Senate file that I think you would say has been properly noticed. I don't want to get into a deep division on this, but there was no intent to hide
I'm
something.
I'm just registering an official objection to the process.
Understood.
Under Rule 12.3. That's
and Senator Rest, have you seen language in the concurrent resolution that makes you uncomfortable?
Mr. Chairman, it's not a matter of substance, it's a matter of process.
All right. Thank you, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Gerlach.
If I could just briefly to,
sure.
to that point, the rule 12.3 does say to the extent practical.
Only on the notice of the committee.
It's not an absolute, or you're saying on the notice of the committee. But then it references the notice must state the bills to be considered, so it's integrally linked. But I just want to make the point that it's to the extent practical is what the rule states.
Thank you, Senator Gerlach. And Senator Rest and Senator Gerlach and committee members, if this committee takes any action, well, frankly, on anything, there will be another opportunity to hear the same language in the full Rules Committee. That's what we will do is deliver report and recommendations to the Rules Committee. Anything else on that, Senator Gerlach? You done?
Yes.
Thank you. True. All right. So then, let us turn to Senate File 1317. And Mr. Bodden, if you would, does everyone have the A1?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I think the A1 was in the packets.
Great.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, I can walk through this subdivision by subdivision and kind of provide a brief explanation of what the original source for these principles is and some comparison with what's been done in the past.
Why don't we start that way, Senator Byron, Mr. Bodden. Thank you.
Very good. So, Mr. Chairman, beginning with subdivision 1 on page 1 of the amendment, you can see that what this is this is codified language. It would be in the statutes, and it's a combined set of principles for both legislative and congressional districts. Subdivision 2 contains the requirement that a representative district may not be divided in the formation of a Senate district. That reflects the Constitution, the state constitutional principle that's in Article 4, Section 3. Subdivision 3 deals with the requirement that legislative districts must be substantially equal in population and then contains in paragraph B a requirement that congressional districts must be as nearly equal in population as practicable. The legislative district requirement reflects a continuing development in that regard. Courts have generally allowed greater latitude for variation in population, but past principles have required, I think, a 2% difference maximum. The Constitution speaks to this by saying the districts must be substantially equal, so that's where that language comes from that you see on line 1.8. With respect to the congressional districts, the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken in that regard, and that's where the language requiring them to be as nearly equal in population as practicable comes from. The 2001 court order that provided principles for the court's plan also reflected that. Looking at subdivision 4, dealing with requirements for contiguity and compactness, again, the original source for this is in the Constitution, the state Constitution, Article 4, Section 3, which relates to Senate districts and thus would translate to House districts as well. There's an additional sentence in there beginning on line 1.14 relating to contiguity by water, which is sufficient if it is not a serious obstacle to travel within the district. That was originally contained in the 1991 resolution that applied to redistricting plans. Then there's a final sentence beginning on 1.15 relating to point contiguity, stating that it is not sufficient. That pretty much reflects what was in the court order in 2001 containing principles for the court plans.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Could I ask a technical question here?
Please.
With regard to point contiguity, when I was reviewing the language earlier, I see that that's not in there. I was in the House version, which of course is what we had available to us. There was, it isn't here. I'm sorry. In subdivision 7, which according to this would be less priority than point contiguity. What if there is point contiguity within a single city or town? And we know that there have been some issues with annexation, et cetera. And I just wonder how, if that's not a contradiction, and what is the rationale and how would you envision subdivision 7 being reconciled with the statement that point contiguity is not sufficient? And I want to understand that.
So, Senator S., you are pointing out, so between subdivision 4, that last sentence that talks about point contiguity is not sufficient, and then the language further down the page, and on the back side in subdivision 7.
About minor civil divisions.
How those work together.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bodern, do you have some thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, I think subdivision 7 deals with the division of a minor civil division, a county, city, or town. I don't think that, and subdivision 4 deals with a situation where you're attempting to include two areas that are connected only by a point. Subdivision 7 would allow that division if, under certain circumstances that you see beginning on line 1.33, I think the two clauses there, if the division occurs because there's a portion of a city or town that's non-contiguous with another portion. So if there were, in effect, I think the short answer is that point contiguity is not prohibited. Or dividing a district that has point contiguity only would not be prohibited by subdivision 7. I don't think they're necessarily in conflict. Subdivision 7 spells out the circumstances where such a division would not be considered an undue division within the meaning of this this restriction. So I don't know if I'm helping you, Senator Rest, if that's assisting you in your understanding of these subdivisions.
Mr. Chairman, I accept the pronouncement that it's not in conflict. I'm not sure that I am totally convinced by the language that there's no conflict, but I just wanted to raise that issue.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Mr. Bonner.
So, Mr. Chairman, then continuing with Subdivision 5, which relates to the numbering of districts, the requirement that legislative districts be numbered in a regular series is provided in the state constitution. The remainder of that language, with one exception that I'll point out, basically reflects past practices and was contained in the 2001 legislative resolutions as they passed each body more or less. This is consistent with those practices. What is different here, you'll see on lines 1.18 and 1.19, is the numbering within the metropolitan area, the inclusion of 11 counties within what is defined as the metropolitan area. And my understanding is that is related to kind of federal definition of what the metropolitan area is. The previous resolutions and past practices have referred to a 7-county metropolitan area, commonly known as what is included within the area subject to the jurisdiction of the Metropolitan Council. The requirement that you see beginning on line 1.21 relates to the numbering of congressional districts, and again, that simply reflects past practices. It's the continued system of numbering. Subdivision 6 deals with minority representation, and paragraph A is the source for that is the Voting Rights Act, and it is intended to reflect what is contained in the Voting Rights Act. Paragraph B contains operative language relating to plans drawn under these principles. And the language here is most similar to what was contained in the 2001 court order relating to the court's plan. There are other versions of this that have been drawn more in the affirmative, that the redistricting plan must make an effort to allow minority communities to elect candidates of their choice. So that's one distinction. Subdivision 7, which we've dealt with somewhat already, states that political subdivisions, and they're named here, counties, cities, or towns, must not be unduly divided unless that's required to meet equal population requirements or to assist in composing districts that are convenient and contiguous. And the original source and concern for avoiding these divisions when it's possible is the 1981 federal court decision. The 1991 resolutions that applied to the legislative plan identified these particular types of subdivisions. That's how it evolved to county, city, or town. The language beginning on 1.33, paragraph B, that we were discussing previously is basically intended to deal with situations that have been created through the annexation process. For example, you'll see on the top of page 2, this is intended to deal with, there's a provision that says if the known population of any affected county, city, or town is wholly located within a single district, that division would be allowable. In other words, if there's a portion of territory in that political subdivision that has been annexed but doesn't have any known population, then such a division would not be considered an undue division within the meaning of these principles. Then moving to page 2, there's language relating to communities of interest. The first time this emerged as a principle in redistricting decisions was in the 1981 federal court decision that applied to that plan. This is phrased a little differently, but is quite similar to previous court orders that have reflected the communities of interest principle. And I believe it's also similar to the 2001 resolution. Subdivision 9 is intended to reflect the practices that have been used in the past. It hasn't necessarily been contained in this form, obviously not in court orders, since this deals with the process the legislature will use. There was language very similar to this in the resolution that Senator Rest proposed. One difference I would point out on line 2.13, there's reference to correction of errors by the U.S. Census Bureau. Senator Rest's resolution also referenced the state demographer there. This does not. Subdivision 10 relates to the process before the legislature may consider a redistricting plan. And again, this reflects past procedures. It has not been contained in this form in a previous resolution or court order that has had a binding effect, to my knowledge. And then subdivision 11 states the provides priority for the principles contained and relates to those in subdivisions 1 through 8. And the last clause there on 2.21 does make it clear that the priority cannot be used to in a manner that would violate federal or state law. That's very similar, the phrasing of priority here in to the same principle that was contained in Senate File 1326 as it was passed in 2001. And finally, the effective date makes it clear these principles are temporary. They would expire June 1st, 2012 and apply to redistricting done for plans in use of the state primary in 2012 and the general election. And that is pretty much what I have. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to take those.
Members, at least initially, here's what I would like to do. We have at least one person who'd like to testify on the principles in general, and I'll ask if there are more. So with your permission, maybe we'll take some testimony and then kind of continue the discussion. We can go through it line by line and working with Mr. Bodden here, make sure people are comfortable. But why don't we – I have Mr. Dean, Mr.
Yes.
Deans. If you could join us at the table. And you may well want to get to specifics, but I was made aware you wanted to talk in general about the principles, and so you can dive as deep or stay as high level as you'd like, Mr. Dean.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. We're a nonpartisan government watchdog group. That works on issues like campaign finance, ethics, and government. But we've been working on redistricting for over 30 years. We were along with the League of Women Voters, one of the major advocates for reform in 1980, which would have created an independent redistricting commission. I want to speak, though, today about some of the issues about principles. We sent you all a letter, Common Cause, the League of Women Voters, Take Action Minnesota, and the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits sent you a letter way back in, I think, February, March, outlining 11 recommendations in which we thought you could use to in terms of improving the redistricting process. I'm pleased today that you've adopted one of those recommendations, and that is to move forward with a conversation about principles. We think that this is a really important part of the process in that it's, you know, really helps kind of set a roadmap for how you're going to engage in the redistricting effort.
Mr. Dean, excuse me, do you have a copy of that letter that we could make available to members? Or
I have one copy.
I don't know if you're going to use that for more of your testimony.
I am not.
I don't have that letter. Well, your decision as to whether you want us to have that in front of us, but
I have one copy.
Maybe if staff could. Thank you. Mr. Dean.
Chair. Principles are not only important for developing a roadmap, but it's also important to really be transparent about the process. I think it sends an important message to the public about how you're going to proceed. And really, public confidence in this process, I think, is really critical sort of going forward. So just as, you know, individual principles really define the integrity of a person, I think that redistricting principles really define the integrity of the process. And so I think this will be an important conversation as you move forward. There's one area that I wanted to make a recommendation on, and that was in terms of adding in an additional principle, and that was around competition. Competition has been considered in the past. It was largely discussed during the last redistricting process, mainly coming through Governor Ventura at the time and his redistricting commission. In years past, the Senate has taken a position on this. If you remember, during the last session, you actually passed a bill that would sort of change the redistricting process. In that bill, it added in competition as a redistricting principle. And some of you did support that legislation. And so I think it's an important step to go forward. One, competition is important really because of the growing political divide that we've seen in this country. A lot of people attribute that partly to the redistricting process because too often redistricting is used as a way to basically create safe congressional seats or in some cases safe legislative seats. I think former President Bush recognized this. In his book recently, he talked about how, quote, our government would be more productive and our politics would be more civilized if congressional districts were drawn by panels of nonpartisan elders instead of partisan state legislators. This would make more competitive general elections and less polarized Congress, unquote. And so he's obviously talking about the process there, but he's also talking about the need for competition. And really, competition is, I think, at the core of our democracy. In the Federalist Papers, Madison talks about how government institutions should be designed to pit competing factors against each other so that not one faction really can become dominant. And unfortunately, what we've seen in the redistricting process is too often safe seats are created. California is one of the worst examples of this. In years past, they have 53 congressional seats. Of those 53, political scientists estimate that only about 4 or 5 of those seats are actually truly competitive, meaning that basically voters turn out for those races and the outcome is already predetermined. And this is too often the problem with redistricting. And the challenge without competition is that it really results in sort of a lack of accountability with elected officials. And so if the voters turn out, the outcome is already predetermined, it's hard for the voters to really hold their elected officials accountable. And competition is really sort of a core principle and is the very foundation of our free markets, with the idea that competition really leads to better results. And so I think that this is a principle that I would encourage you to adopt, because it's really critical to, you know, help improve our political system by encouraging this level of competition in both the legislative and congressional seats, and as you draw the lines to keep that in mind. And so you know, we'd rather have sort of the knowledgeable, sort of election-tested legislators over really the party loyalists and sort of created that in protected districts. And so I think it's really important that we look at ways to do that. Some have raised concerns about this in the past in terms of that it's really challenging to define competition. I would disagree with that. One, you've done it in the past as a body, and so I think that's an incorrect statement. Two, your political staff are already developing competition. I would be surprised if, as you draw maps, you're not already looking at a party makeup of individuals. And so competitions are already being considered right now. It's just a matter of how. And so the way that they've considered in the past, in 2000, they looked at sort of party affiliation of the minor constitutional officers and looked at the party turnout for both of those races, Secretary of State, State Auditor, and used it as a way to determine competition, and then tried to create a balanced number of districts in which there were competitive elections. Because you're not going to have a competitive election in every single legislative race, but the goal is to have sort of overall a larger number of competitive elections. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Koch.
Thanks for your testimony, and I agree. I mean, competitiveness is good. That's the foundation of free market principles, and I appreciate that. I would suggest that our legislative districts have been very competitive in the last decade. In 06, you saw, particularly if we're talking about the Senate, you saw large turnover to the DFL party and lots of pickup seats in what I think people would have maybe even characterized as not competitive districts. And then in the last election, you saw a 16-seat pickup, and again, in districts that some may have not considered competitive. So, you know, I think that it's not – I appreciate your, you know, trying to define what competitiveness is, but I think that ultimately the voters will decide, and I think that we've seen them decide, and I think we've seen some very competitive races in the last year, the last decade. Any thoughts?
Mr. Chair.
It's a big conversation.
Yes, it is. I think it's important to remember who drew the maps the last time, though, and that was the courts. And so now you're moving forward with a slightly different process where the legislature has said it's committed to drawing maps this time. And I think it's important, if you're going to draw the maps, that you have competition in there as a criteria. Now, in 2001, 2002, the courts did not incorporate competition officially as a principle. They strove towards it, though, but they were it was not a principle, but I think it was an objective. And so I think that shows you the benefits of having competition in there as an idea, in that it's something the courts sort of tried to do that last time, and I think we've had relatively competitive elections because of that. Where we've seen uncompetitive elections has really been in other states where the legislature has drawn the maps. And too often when legislatures have drawn the maps, we've had relatively uncompetitive elections at the congressional level or the state legislative level. And so since you've decided to sort of take this on this year and sort of, you know, ensure that the legislature draws the maps, that I think it's really important that that criteria be added to prevent the problems that we've seen in other states.
And Mr. Dean, maybe even bigger picture question here. What would your organization prefer, that the legislature draw the map or a court?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Dean.
My preference would be neither. I think that we've been out there advocating for independent redistricting commission, similar to a bill that was moved forward in the Senate last cycle, which I believe you actually supported, that would create sort of an appointed group that would be appointed by the leadership of basically both the House and the Senate, the majority and minority parties of both bodies. I think that's an ideal way that allows you still to have a say in the process, but it removes the conflict of interest that inherently exists when legislators draw their own maps.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've noticed as I've been studying these principles in the recent past here and also today, they're very objective. You can back these up with data. I mean, you can look and you can see if you're following these or not. With somewhat of the exception of possibly the community of interest, you know, you might be able to debate that one a little bit, but it has a definition with that. I'm really concerned about when we enter in something about competitiveness and we try to define what competitiveness is. I don't know how you measure that. Now, I know that Mr. Dean said, well, in the past, the measure used was constitutional officer races, and that was your benchmark or the benchmark, I think, that you seem to like. But first question is, Mr. Dean, do you think that what affects the votes on a race, would you think that the quality of a candidate impacts what those numbers are? You think the quality of a candidate, by quality, I mean the perception, how they present themselves, you know, there's a lot more than just the issues at stake. I mean, a lot of it is the quality of how someone presents themselves to their constituents. Does that matter at all? It's very subjective.
Senator Gerlach's got a lot of quality, Mr. Dean.
Mr. Chair, yes, he does. You're right. I mean, this is very challenging to sort of create a standard that would work in terms of that doesn't take account sort of other factors. I mean, when you look at, let's look at the last two races here. I mean, you have different candidates and people vote on candidates, not necessarily party line. And the thing to keep in mind when evaluating competition is that it's a goal, it's an objective. The challenge that we see is that too often, again, in other states, maps are drawn in a way to benefit one political party or the other. And so what we're trying to prevent is really the extremes here. What we're trying to prevent is races where, you know, basically you split the House, where there's four Democrats, four Republicans. Those are safe seats for both members of Congress, and the outcome's already predetermined. We think that is a bad outcome. Now, the question is, how do you define that? And I think that is the challenge that you would have to move forward with. I outlined sort of one area that you could do that by looking at the state constitutional officers. There's actually a project at at Harvard University right now that's looking at this. And they actually have are creating a formula that really evaluates competition in congressional elections. And they're making that information available to anyone that wants to use it to help evaluate this sort of level of competition. And they try to look at a variety of different pieces of information, whether it's those constitutional officers, whether it's other state legislative races, to create sort of a true index of competition. But I think it's important to remember that you're already looking at competition already. And so it's already being biased in some way, because I guarantee that your political staff are looking at these issues right now, and they're looking at voting returns in past elections. And so if you think it's really that bad of an idea, then I would encourage you to not look at any competition, any political data at all, and actually outright forbid members from drawing lines using that type of information as you move forward.
And Senator Gerlach, I'll recognize you in a second, but I recall, I don't want this to seem like a quote, but you remember when Mr. Watson joined us last month, and he talked a little bit about competition and how using different frameworks, literally the same map can look very, very different depending on this index that you choose to use. He ended up saying something like competition is in the eye of the beholder. Well, I don't know if that's where you were going, Senator Gerlach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes, that is true. I'm going in the direction of I believe that competition is far too subjective to use in what I hope to have as an objective list of principles. Mr. Dean, if I could ask you also, does it matter if there is an independent or independence party or third party candidates in particular races? Will that, if you're trying to look at competitive, some sort of measurements of competitiveness, whether or not there is an independent factor in a race, that independent candidate oftentimes will draw from one side or the other depending on their particular issues or campaign they're running, and that can dramatically impact what you think might be a competitive index, and then we draw these districts. The next race may not have that factor in it, and the competition level could be radically different, so it's not consistent. So my question is, does a third-party candidate affect the competitiveness calculation which you would propose?
Mr. Dean.
Mr. Chair, it potentially does. I think it's important to remember, though, I just want to go back to your earlier statement that you're trying to develop principles that are objective, not subjective. I would actually argue that many of these principles before you are subjective. A lot of this is based upon court precedent, especially dealing with the Voting Rights Act. I mean, I remember court case basically, or the Supreme Court justices saying, I know there's a problem when I see it, and that's the standard that they've created in some of these issues, particularly around compactness. There's no true definition around compactness. It's I know it when I see it. And so I think you have to remember that these are relatively subjective sort of terms, and part of what you are doing in this process is weighing these terms then too. Because as Senator Rest brought up earlier, these are going to be in conflict throughout the process. And so you have to, that is going to then evolve in some level of subjectivity as you sort of weigh which principles are important, which are not to you. And so all I'm advocating for is that this be one of the things that you consider as you move forward. The true definition of that, I think, unfortunately, would be in the eye of the beholder. But again, many of the principles before you, I think that their true definition is in the eye of the beholder.
Mr. Chairman, another question along the same lines, but I know this one is near and dear to your heart, and that has to do with money. In your opinion, does the amount of money spent in a race alter the outcome, thereby altering the statistics, thereby altering the information that we may use in a competitiveness? Does money impact the outcome of races?
Mr. Dean, we're going wide here. This is a very interesting discussion. Mr. Dean.
Mr. Chair, yes, it does. I mean, as you know, Common Cause is concerned about the large influx of money into politics and how that skews the public debate. And so I would argue that, yes, it does. But again, this, going back to my original point here, is that no matter what sort of definition of competition you look at, and sort of the data, it's going to be skewed in some way or another. I think the important thing, though, is that are you trying to create competitive elections here? Because what we're trying to prevent is safe seats from being created right now. So if you produce a map, again, that's four Democrats, four Republicans, and in the 2012 election, the four members on the Democratic side win by 60%, the four members on the Republican side win by 60%, I consider that very uncompetitive. And that would be problematic. And what we're trying to do is prevent that type of thing from happening. My hope is that you would just do that naturally, that you try to strive for competition without having it be there as a principle. But what we've seen, unfortunately, from other states, it's really necessary to incorporate in as a key principle to prevent those type of safe districts from happening.
And then, Mr. Chairman, just to conclude, not with another question, but I guess my line of questions was that Many factors beyond our control. Not this is not demographics. This is not. I mean, I'm not talking about. You know, we get the data from the census, and it is what it is. But in what Mr. Dean is proposing to us in this competitiveness is that that there are many subjective factors that influence what those numbers would be that are political in nature, and they are whether you know certainly the quality of the candidate impacts those numbers, the whether there's a third party candidate or not, and clearly money is a factor. And when those things come together, you get wild numbers that don't reflect what you would like. And I share your. I get it. I think competitive elections are important, but when we start to look at all of that criteria and draw districts based on that, that makes me nervous because of the wild fluctuations in all the various different races. So that's my.
Well, and Senator Gerlach, you know, we could go even deeper on this. I mean, how would you fit primary challenges and campaigns into a competitiveness discussion?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I think all the data proposes from general election.
Yes.
You know, not necessarily with primaries, but still the, again, it's a lot of factors that influence these numbers.
Senator Nino, did you ever? Okay. Can I ask, is there anyone else in the room with us this morning that would like to provide some testimony or some background on the legislation in front of the committee? Further questions for Mr. Dean? Mr. Dean, thank you.
Great, thank you.
So, members, let me make kind of an overarching comment here. I believe what we've put together here in this A1 sets up a good framework for us. A lot of this language is we've seen before, has been used before. And I think these can serve as a good guide for us as we then go about the process of putting together a legislative and a congressional map. What do we want to do? We want to protect all Minnesotans' rights to equal representation. One person, one vote. We want to comply with all applicable laws, particularly the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And we want to place a priority on limiting city or county or other government unit splits. You know, there's a couple things we can't change. We can't change the census data that we've received and the new population and demographics of Minnesota. The other thing we can't change is we have 87 counties, 855 cities, and over 1,700 townships. And that's required by law. We want to honor as many of those as we can. And so I think that is what these principles will help us do and will help us set those up as priorities. We also want to keep communities of interest intact. I'm sure that'll be another discussion that we have going forward. So I think what is embedded in the A1 will do that. And so I'll ask for questions or comment, and my intent would be to move the A1. Senator Nino.
Just a question, Mr. Chair. I know over the years there's been discussion about, and I'm not proposing anything, but just asking, there's been discussion about legislative districts crossing over congressional district boundaries. I know in the northwest suburbs at one point there was a Senate district, I think, that was in, I think, three different congressional districts. And there's nothing in here, but was there discussion about that? I'm in two districts, congressional districts, but just minor. I have one city, two precincts, about 8,000, 9,000 people in the 6th, and the rest of my district that I represent is up in the 8th. And so I'm aware of it, which is why it came to mind. It's not a particular problem for me personally, but for some of, and I don't know so much for even my constituents, but I certainly hear a lot from activists about some of the confusion that it creates for them. Just about that.
And Senator Nino, I don't think that has ever risen to a principle. I don't know if Mr. Bonner, you have some background on that issue of kind of the syncing up of literally the two maps that we're obligated to put together.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any court requirement for that or any principles that required nesting legislative districts within congressional districts.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
We would have no objection to adopting the A1 as an author's amendment, if that's how you would like to proceed, and then we have some amendments. Or if you would like our suggested improvements through amendments to be offered to the A1 before it's voted on. Either way is fine with us.
If you have no preference, Senator Rest, then why don't we we'll take action on the A1. All in favor of adopting the A1, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. So we have the A1 adopted.
And Mr. Chair, procedurally, that probably was a better approach in case you want to tweak the language of your amendments. An amendment to an amendment can't be amended, but
we now have Senate File 1317 as amended before us. Sounds like Senator Rest wanted to.
I think Senator Bach has an amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A3 amendment.
A3.
Simple little thing.
I think everyone's got the A3 now, Senator Bach. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, I
oh, sorry, I didn't get to your side. Just look over his shoulder. Sorry, Bart.
My eyes aren't that good.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've moved the A3, and the I guess the description of it's pretty easy. In the A1, you indicate that we're going to start in the northwestern corner of the state, redistrict the state. Leaving out the 11 county metropolitan area, and then once the other 76 counties are all done, then you'll come back and redo the 11 counties and really define those as metropolitan districts. I'm a little unwilling as a rural member to just give up more four counties and say, well, these are now metropolitan districts. Previously, we've defined the metropolitan area as seven counties. We've redrawn the state around those seven counties and then came back and redrew the seven counties at the end. And I'd like to proceed in the same way. Clearly, we're going to have a smaller amount of what I would probably describe as rural representation when this process is done. But I think this exacerbates that even further to just presume that 11 counties are going to be metropolitan districts. So I'd like to go back to seven, which I think is previously where the legislature has been in this process.
Well, thank you, Senator Bach. So my understanding is it's actually the Census Bureau that uses this, that now uses this 11 county metropolitan area definition. That's the batch of demographic material that we do and will use. And so it's really their definition. You still have some discomfort that this somehow is creates a geographical distinction that you're not comfortable with?
Well, I think it does. I mean, I think it just presumes we're going to draw metropolitan districts within 11 counties. And I think some of that ground is clearly rural and should probably be have the opportunity to include it in rural districts. And this would absolutely take that opportunity to include those four additional counties as part of any kind of a rural district. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Koch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Bach. And obviously, one of my counties is one of the additional four. And I don't know that we're always, of course, hesitant to be lumped in with the metropolitan counties, so I appreciate what you're saying. However, a function of demographic, I mean, to this is probably just a function of the demographics. I don't think it makes us less, more metro or less rural by the numbering of it. We're going to be who we're going to be regardless of, you know, what number our district is. I just...
Senator Rest.
Well, I think another argument in favor of Senator Bach's motion is that the Census Bureau also in the metropolitan area includes two counties in Wisconsin. So it is an artificial distinction in my mind that we cannot assert that the metropolitan area is one in which is defined by the seven counties. And, Mr. Chairman, I request a roll call.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is more of a technical and almost tangential question, but for Mr. Bodern, this distinction actually affects a large part of my district. Right now, if we use the 11-county metropolitan area, the district I represent as currently configured would fall completely within that. If we used a 7-county metropolitan area, it would fall partially within that. How does that affect the numbering? If the district I represent were to be configured as it is now, where would I fall? Is it measured by a percentage, or do you have to be entirely within that metropolitan area as defined?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nino, and without reference to maps at the moment, the way I would read this is if it's any portion of your district would be included in that area, it wouldn't be numbered within that 11-county grouping until the remainder had been numbered, if that assists you.
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. If any portion of the district were to fall within, whether it's 7 or 11, if any portion of a district were to fall within those identified counties, then that district would be numbered with all the rest of the districts that are in those counties.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nino, that's correct. I think that's an accurate restatement of what I said. And what might be helpful is if we look at the way the 7-county area is numbered right now and whether there are districts touching that 7-county area that are included within that numbering sequence.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bodern, then we're not, this is not how it's configured at this point, because I have literally about 200 people in Hennepin County, but it's as it's configured now, I'm in the outside the 7-county metro area, so that I'm not numbered within.
Mr. Bodern.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Koch, thank you. That helps in understanding at least how this has been interpreted in the past. There's obviously a subjective component to the numbering here.
Senator Bach, your public policy rationale for this your amendment is not that you think it's important what the number of any single Senate district. Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, but just as an example, Senator Nino brought it up himself. I think your district number now is what,
17?
17. The way this is worded, your district would probably be changed into the 30s. And whether that is of any import or not, that's probably what would happen.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest. Yeah, I don't know that that really matters. That's, I guess, my point is, Senator Ortman and I have somewhat similar districts. She maybe is a little more metro than I. She's considered a metro county. We are not. It doesn't really change who we are, and the number isn't much of a concern to us. We're fiercely independent on who we are.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Nino.
I'm one of those ex-urban, you know, high growth districts. I think population of mine is, I think, the fifth largest in the state now for Senate districts, fourth or fifth, not as big as yours. But there's, yeah, there's quite a distinction from the southeast portion, which is straight up the freeway in southern Chisago County, very much suburban bedroom community, and you get into the northern portion of the district and very rural. So I over the years, I've always told people that I'm neither here nor there. I'm not fully rural, and I'm not fully suburban metropolitan. So I don't know that this particularly makes any big difference to me in general, but it was just a tangential question that came up about how that numbering actually would work.
Thank you, Senator Nino. So Senator Bach offers the A3. Senator Rest has requested a roll call. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Michelle?
No.
Senator Bach?
Yes.
Senator Gerlach?
No.
Senator Harrington?
Yes.
Senator Koch?
No.
Senator Nino?
No.
Senator Rest?
Yes.
And Senator Senjum?
There being 3 aye and 4 nays, the A3 is not adopted. Senator Harrington, you're being cued.
I'm being cued. So actually, I was next up anyway.
Great.
and follow-up to the conversation we had at the last meeting about making the process transparent and making sure that we had minority representation involved in this, I'd like to offer the A4 amendment.
A4.
Make sure my this side gets it first.
Okay, Senator Harrington, the A4.
The A4 substitutes some different language for subdivision 6.
We have the A8.
Oh, sorry.
This, you gave it to us early, Senator Harrington, but you gave us the wrong one.
I thought I had the A4.
I don't have a
A8. Barb, who has the A4?
I had the A4, and that's in the packet.
I got a second copy of the A3.
These must be all your amendments. These must be
one of us had one copy of each one in a stack, maybe?
So we all got different.
Oh, no.
I got another copy of A3.
Okay, we got an A4. That's why we let Barb.
Who wants an A4?
Can we reshuffle these and take.
I'd like to vote on that one again anyway, so.
Those are all 12, 13, 14.
Oh, sorry.
That's
okay. Could have. Here you go. Does everyone have the A4? Okay.
I've got the A4 now. I'm not sure now.
Senator Harrington, the A4. You were speaking to it. I know you were.
Okay, well, there we go. So this would substitute some language for subdivision 6, which talks about minority representation. When you were making your comments on the A1, you spoke to that this was in your A1, and I appreciate that. I think my language is a little bit more aggressive, perhaps. It's got a little more punch to it than yours in this case. I would note that it was this is the language that was part of the Senate's redistricting principles in 2001. So this was language that we've already agreed on once upon a time. It was also the same language that was established in the courts in the 80s for both the legislative and the congressional plans. The reason I would like to see this included in is because one of the conversations I have is that the representation in both the House and the Senate is dramatically under what we should have in terms of proportional representation to our population. The state of Minnesota is about almost 13%, 12 to 13% communities of color. And both the Senate and the House are about 3%, with Senator Torres Ray and myself making up the communities of color for the Senate, and then Bobby Joe, Jeff, and Rena making up, I think, and Carlos making up the representation in the House. That's a 9% differential there that I think we really should really make our principles speak to. It says we really do want to make sure that our legislative bodies are representative of the communities that we do represent. And so I think this language says that districts must not dilute the voting strength, which is common language there. But it adds in that the districts must increase the probability, not the certainty, but the probability that members of the minority will be elected.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Harrington. So as Senator Harrington noted, members, we're talking about subdivision 6 of the A1 that's been adopted as now Senate File 1317. So members, our principles, you know, we must produce a map that complies with the Voting Rights Act. That's a given. I'm confident that what is in the A1 will accomplish that, and I think it's important. I appreciate what you're trying to do with Senator Harrington, but I would oppose the A4.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest.
Roll call.
Senator Rest requests a roll call. Keep the clerk busy. Members, a further discussion on the A4. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Michelle.
No.
Senator Bach.
Yes.
Senator Gerlach.
No.
Senator Harrington.
Yes.
Senator Cope.
No.
Senator Nino.
No.
Senator Rest.
Yes.
Senator Senjum.
All right, there being 3 aye and 4 nay, the A4 is not adopted. Further discussion, members. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I have an oral amendment. and it would be to insert the language of subdivision 8 at line 212 or 213 and then reorder the subdivisions.
Senator Rest, I'm going to ask you to do that again.
It's just simply
me, just
moving subdivision 8.
Moving it down?
No, it's moving it above subdivision 7.
All right, so I'll ask you to
subdivision
speak
8 would
to
become
it.
The new subdivision 7. Subdivision 7 would become a new subdivision 8.
Senator Rest, are you working off of the A1 or are you working off the original bill? Because you're numbering. I'm not following the lines you're talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Senator Rest. Thank you, Senator Koch. I think I even.
No, it's.
We're looking at the
A1.
The A1 that we adopted, Senator Koch.
Yes.
And now I'm moving to move subdivision 8, preserving communities of interest.
On 2.3.
Above.
1.3.
Subdivision 7. Yeah.
1.3.
I have
okay.
The line numbers wrong.
Yes, thank you. All
right. And then I would speak to it.
Senator Rest, to
Mr.
Your
Mr. Chairman and members, subdivision 11 sets forward that the principles in 1 through 8 be considered in priority order. And it seems to me that preserving communities of interest should have a higher priority listing than the geopolitical boundaries of counties and cities and towns. And I don't object to the language in either one, but it seems to me that the priority listing would be would better serve our work here if communities of interest were a higher priority than minor civil divisions.
Further discussion, members?
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Grove.
I know that there's always this talk every 10 years about Minneapolis and St. Paul, that they're so similar to, you know, put them together, and we always have that interesting debate. But
the one that
we
lives
don't
in
do
Minneapolis, St. Paul would ever say.
we don't do that, you know, and that's, you know, so the minor civil division sort of wins out in the argument, but Senator Ress's amendment would almost lend to the notion that you have a stronger argument to put Minneapolis and St. Paul together into a single congressional district. And I'm intrigued by the if I'm interpreting that correctly, is that a potential outcome of your amendment, Senator Rest?
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, you can draw whatever implications you want from them. I believe that the communities of interest should have a higher priority than minor civil divisions. Without hypothetically indicating what that would be.
And
well taken.
Senator Rest, I appreciate the direction what you're trying to do and trying to set some priorities here. What comforts me with the A1 as it is that, as you'll note, our subdivision 6, in talking about minority representation, we are giving that more priority than the division splits, those minor civil divisions. So as adopted already by the committee, I think we're moving and honoring that some of the same notion that you're talking about. So I would oppose your oral amendment, but appreciate the discussion.
Roll call.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's I know we get bogged down trying to link the communities of interest with the minority issue, but it's about more than that. I mean, I just kind of look at the Iron Range, for example. The mining industry in those mine towns are a community of interest. I mean, they have a lot in common. And so it's about, I think we need to be careful that the communities of interest is about more than just minority representation.
I think we're all in agreement on that, Senator Bach. I think you'd also say that.
Except you're making a very low priority in the list here.
Yes. Just to finish a discussion, this is kind of the tensions and the pushes and the pulls here as we try to put together principles. And I know you would also say that township lines, city lines, county lines, up on in your district or across the state are also important. And so. I don't think they are as important and as reflected in this, in the A1, as minority representation.
Well,
and I understand,
Mr. Chairman,
it's
I'm not
important enough to have language about communities of interest, and that's why we do have it in there.
I'm not suggesting it's more important than minority representation. I'm suggesting that it's more important than some arbitrary boundary along a river or a township line that the interest that those communities jointly share is more important than the arbitrary boundary of the community, which oftentimes is simply geographic.
Senator Koch.
Mr. Chairman and members, maybe I'm taking this. I take this as these are all important. I take these redistricting principles as these are all important and must all be taken into consideration. I'm not understanding that there's a ranking.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
is there a priority?
Senator Koch, you want to eliminate subdivision 11.
I think that if it makes the list, however, it's all important. I mean, this is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Koch, then are you going to move to delete subdivision 11?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest.
One amendment at a time, Senator.
Yeah, I think I'm working on one amendment. But, you know, I think that, you know, these have all got to be taken into consideration.
So let me see if I can
Mr. Chairman,
make sure it's stated. Senator Rest.
Then maybe six should be.
Then I think, you know, if you look at make sure I've got the one here. Lines 220, or subdivision 11, priority of principles. It's clear that subdivisions 1 through 8 are to be given priority, except to the extent that, in a priority order, except to the extent that doing so would violate federal law. So there is a setting forth of here of what the legislature would consider to act on first.
And so, members, just so I make sure I state what's in front of us, and Senator Ress has asked for a roll call vote. So this would be a reordering of subdivision 7, subdivision 8.
That's correct.
Flipping those. So that subdivision 8 would now become subdivision 7. And subdivision 7 would now become subdivision 8. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Michelle.
No.
Senator Bach.
Yes.
Senator Gerlach.
No.
Senator Harrington.
Yes.
Senator Koch.
No.
Senator Nienow.
No.
Senator Rest.
Yes.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you. There being 3 aye and 4 nay, the Rest oral amendment is not adopted.
Chairman.
Senator Rest.
We have the A8 amendment.
The A8. You could pass that out to those who don't have it already.
Chairman.
Senator Rest, to the A8.
A statement about making sure that our plans that we offer are neutral with regard to either protecting or defeating an incumbent, and I refer to the statement by the courts that indeed recommended a similar statement with regard to the redistricting plans, where they said, and I quote, "We adopt the parties," and this was the parties to the suit, which represented the major political parties, "stipulation that districts should not be drawn for the purpose of protecting or defeating incumbents." And so I think it would be a real affirmation of that to our Minnesota constituencies if the legislature followed that recommendation from the courts from 10 years ago. And so offer it as a subdivision 9, that it would be, again, in terms of priorities, it would be it would come after the ones you already have in the A1 amendment, but that it would be a good statement to make to the Minnesota public about how seriously we consider our work, that incumbency is a neutral position with regard to our plans.
Senator Gerlach on it to the A8.
Mr. Chairman, I have two questions sent for Senator Resta. It was there any findings of fact on were there? I guess I'm not familiar with the exact details surrounding this or what the court said, but was there a, were they reacting to some sort of a finding of fact that districts were from legislative or plans were drawn with the purpose of protecting or defeating an incumbent? Because I know the court plan had paired what I thought was a shockingly high number of incumbents. I mean, I think there was 9 in the Senate and 17 House members. Well, actually, it'd be 34 House members and 18 senators were paired. I mean, usually, I mean that's certainly an indication of defeating incumbents and such. I mean, the courts did a lot of that. I'm just wondering if there was any finding of fact that any plans that were drawn, were there any districts drawn for the point the purpose of protecting or defeating an incumbent?
Mr. Rest. Chairman, the statement I read was from the memorandum and from the court case that was dated and signed December 11th, 2001. I think the statement speaks for itself.
And
Senator
Grodek, you had a second point.
Just my thought is how, Senator Rest, how would you, so the legislature puts forth a plan, say it's signed by the governor. How would anyone look at that and say, aha, that was drawn with the intent to, or the purpose of protecting or defeating incumbent? How do you measure that? I don't know how you do that practically.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman and Senator Gerlach, I believe that the people of Minnesota would be the judge of whether we had acted in a responsible manner with regard to incumbent neutrality.
Senator Cope.
Mr. Chair, as I follow down on the court memorandum, they say, as a practical matter, those proposed criteria might well conflict with the stipulation and with this panel's goal in redistricting, which is neither to maximize nor minimize political opportunities for any political party, but to ensure the final redistricting plan is fundamentally fair and based primarily on the state's population and secondarily on neutral districting. And what I would suggest, that goes along with what Mr. Dean's testimony spoke of, where he said that, well, they did not adopt this as a principle, and we're adopting first principles here. They adopted it as a secondary objective, which we could all keep in mind in our redistricting plans, but they did not adopt it as a first principle, and I would argue that that goes largely to what Senator Gerlach has brought up, as principles tend to be more objective. Well, this tends to be more subjective, and therefore even the courts did not put it as a primary principle but as a secondary objective.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest.
I think you need to read further in the statement. Nevertheless, because a redistricting plan based solely on mathematics may inadvertently result in the most adverse impact on a particular group, and they cite the case, we are prepared to consider a plan's effect on incumbents in order to prevent an unfair result for either incumbents or potential challengers. It would seem to me that we could be proactive with regard to that and have as a principle, not of the first order, but as a principle, if you will, of the ninth order, that our plans could be judged by the people as being neutral with regard to incumbents. I don't know, but if I, a roll call on that one too.
Senator Rest, ask for a roll call.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nino.
Well, this, along Senator Gerlach's lines with the competitiveness, this, this seems to me to be the same concept, but scoped down specifically for incumbents, in the ambiguity of, or ambiguity is the wrong word, but the lack
vague
of definition for what is
vague
competition. How do we define competitive? And then in the particular context of incumbents, I just think about how maps are drawn, and when we at some point have to make a decision about do these two incumbents get paired or do they not, I almost, feel like we'd be in a catch-22 because on one hand, I can't say, yes, I want to pair them because one of them will be defeated then. But yet on the other hand, I can't say, no, I can't pair them. I need to keep them apart because then they're protected. So no matter what decision I make in that particular circumstance, I'm violating one half of the principle here. But yet I'm certain inevitably some of us are going to be paired. I just can't imagine we get a map where some of us aren't paired. And that tied in with the whole question of how do I really define at what point am I protecting an incumbent and at what point am I trying to defeat an incumbent? And I don't know. I don't get how we do this.
I appreciate that, Senator Nino. And I think where you are going is, again, to kind of keep these principles. And the principles that we have focused on and that courts and other legislatures have focused on, I think serve us pretty well. And without getting into competitiveness or incumbency, again, you talk about equal representation. The numbers are what the numbers are. Talk about the Voting Rights Act, talk about communities of interest, talk about the city and county and township splits. That's a heavy lift to do all those things, and that is what we have to do. But to add on to that some ideals that might be a little more vague, and I'm particularly... uncomfortable with the word the purpose, the purpose of protecting. I don't know how you, again, I think we're kind of back into the eye of the beholder. And yeah, I know Senator Rest brings us with good intent, so I...
Mr. Chairman.
And she's asked for roll call vote. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, just to make a minor correction, Senator Koch indicated that that this particular statement as a principle was not one that the courts adopted, but indeed it was. With regard to the congressional districts, redistricting principle number 8, districts may not be drawn for the purpose of protecting or defeating an incumbent. And with regard to legislative districts, redistricting principle number 9, districts may not be drawn for the purpose of protecting or defeating an incumbent. What she and I were quoting previously was the memorandum that referenced the order. So this is not my good intention, Mr. Chairman and members. It indeed was the court's.
Senator Rest, you always have good intention.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest, I was actually quoting Mr. Dean, who said that was not used as a principle but as an objective. Mr. Dean, is that?
I was just referring to competition. Yeah.
Competition.
Yeah, we've kind of mixed that conversation a little bit. And Senator Rest, you were, yeah, so we've gone back and forth there between court language and court memorandum. I've seen other court language that even the court kind of tied itself up in protecting incumbents versus avoiding excessive incumbent conflicts. I think that was their exact word, excessive incumbent conflict. Again, I think these are the principles that we can use to build two good maps. That's our obligation. I don't think this language is necessary. Clerk, will take the roll on the A8.
Chair Michelle.
No.
Senator Back.
Yes.
Senator Gerlach.
No.
Senator Harrington.
Yes.
Senator Koch.
No.
Senator Nino.
No.
Senator Rest.
Yes.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you. review, there being 3 aye and 4 nay, the A8 is not adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A7 amendment.
Okay. Staff, thank you for an aerobic day.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Ress, this kind of follows well the last
discussion
conversation
on and opinions expressed on political competitiveness. It seems to me it would be appropriate to have position of the members of the subcommittee on the issue of political competitiveness. And so I would move the A7 and ask for a roll call.
Senator Rest, how do you encourage political competitiveness? Encourage is a word that's standing out to me in this.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that you can answer that question for yourself.
Senator Bach, how do we encourage political competitiveness in your...
Mr. Chairman, maybe we should get the dictionary and get a good definition of the word.
A definition of competitiveness or a definition of encourage? Oh. Maybe both. I think Senator Rest's amendment's going to get a little longer if we do that. Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know about the encourage, but I'm zeroing in on the competitiveness. And much like on Subdivision 8, where we talk about communities of interest, and then we have the paragraph B where we say this is what it means, I would feel more comfortable, or at least it would open up the debate on if there was a more to this A7 amendment that said, for the purposes of the subdivision, competitiveness is defined as or means, and then we put that question here and we decide that. We talked about all the different influences on it. By what standard do we use? Do we use these constitutional offices? How do we account for the money or the candidates or the independent third-party candidates, or how do we do that? Or how many years do we go back in election data? How do we average it? How do we do all of that? What is the definition of competitiveness? And I don't know that we would ever agree on that.
Senator Nino.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to speak earlier when we had the testifier at the table, and I held off, but now we're back again. And so I'm with Senator Gerlach in that competitiveness is just it's something we could try to define it, and maybe if we had a longer amendment, we could come to some sort of agreement as to how that's defined. But there are so many things at play in the legislative race. And I'll use myself as an example. In 2002, and I've told this to many people, in 2002, I won an election I wasn't supposed to win. And in 2006, I lost an election I wasn't supposed to lose. Nobody saw either one of those coming, I don't think. Maybe the two members that were in the caucuses at the time could talk to that from your perspectives. But and the geographic area that I represent, the Senate district that I currently represent, as I'm thinking back through in my mind, I believe the last five general elections, we've had a different person elected than previously, but I don't know that ever, maybe for one or two of those, it was viewed as a particularly competitive race, but I don't think that in either of the rest of them, it ever really was targeted, at least in the general. We had one special election that obviously was highly targeted. There's so many dynamics that come into play that how do we really quantify what makes an election in a particular district competitive? And maybe we could get there, but I don't think so. But I do want to say that I think competitiveness is a very good thing. In my opinion, some of the craziest characters we've seen down here come from the safest districts, and I think there's a direct correlation there. And that's on the left and the right, by the way. So I think competitiveness is a good thing because it makes sure that those elected representatives keep their ear to the ground and understand what the people want. So I'm not a fan of safe districts, but I just don't want to go too long with this, but I'm with Senator Gerlach. What does that mean, and how can we actually begin to really quantify what that is?
Further discussion? And Senator Rest, you did request a roll call?
Yes.
Clerk will take the roll on the A7.
Chair Michelle?
No.
Senator Bach?
Yes.
Senator Gerlach?
No.
Senator Harrington?
Yes.
Senator Koch?
No.
Senator Nino?
No.
Senator Rest?
Yes.
Senator Senjum?
There being 3 aye and 4 nay, the A7 is not adopted. Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question on the rank order of the priority. The data to be used is 9, whereas I'm just wondering, maybe Mr. Botter knows the answer to this, but I would think the data to be used, which is not a real debatable topic with us, that should be, shouldn't that be foundational? Shouldn't that be, it's not a principle, but it's on the list of principles. This is data to be used. I'm just wondering why it isn't.
We could amend the head note.
1 through 8 are.
Oh, I see. Okay. I got it. My question has been answered, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gerlach, you have a fine resource next to you.
Mr. Chairman.
An arrest.
Mr. Chairman, I have an A12 amendment.
Senator Rest,
Mr. Chairman,
to the A12.
The A12, and I request a roll call. I would suggest that we really do need to have a period of public comment from all over the state, communities all over the state, after the release, as the amendment states, of the preliminary plans. Before we take action on them. So this would call for 8 hearings before we acted, and it doesn't say on 8 separate days, some of them because the proximity of the district lines could indeed be taken and held in a very small number of days, but I think it would be the responsible thing to do to reach out to the public and the citizens of Minnesota and let them give us their reaction to the plans that are being proposed within the legislature, and to be able to establish a record of public comment and to do that not just in the, you know, one area, or certainly not just here in St. Paul, where absent Mr. Dean's testimony, there's been no public comment even on our process. And it seems to me that when we do have plans to offer to the public that we step back and take some time to hear from them. So in that spirit, I offer the 8-12.
And Senator Est, you would have these hearings in kind of geographically divided up by congressional district.
Mr. Chairman, yes, and recalling that we are not only drawing or charged with drawing legislative districts, but also with congressional districts, and it seems to me that that is the even though we would be doing, and I guess with regard to the current lines of those districts, that that could get a really bona fide cross section of discussion from the public by having a hearing in each congressional district.
Senator Nina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that first pops to my mind is all of these hearings are public, obviously, as are all legislative hearings.
The room is packed.
And we don't, not that this is a bad idea to do, but I enjoy the road shows when they're done. But we don't do this for any other legislation that could affect generations. Why is it more important for this than other laws that we might pass that would be on the books for ever, maybe, potentially?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Nienow, as you've said, that it is a prerogative of committee chairs and leadership to have those to have hearings outside of this Capitol building on a number of issues. I would submit that it is we are speaking to the interests of Minnesotans and their representation, whether in the United States Congress or in the Minnesota legislature, and that it behooves us to reach out to those communities that are represented in congressional districts, rather than demanding that if they want to be heard, they need to make a trip to St. Paul on this issue.
Yeah, Senator Nienow, it actually strikes me that this wouldn't be a bad kind of general thought. I don't know if I want to call it a principle, but for the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't you... Again, kind of speaking at 20,000-foot state Senate level, why wouldn't we take the budget on the road? Why wouldn't you take the governor's budget as proposed on the road and require that of yourself? You know, at some point, there obviously is a limit to what the body just can do and juggle and put together in a five-month session. Senator Cole.
Mr. Chair, and now I'm going to ask Senator Rest to kind of reach back from the last time around. Was this a part of the principles adopted in 01 or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Koch, I don't know. I don't know the extent to which there were public hearings. I know that what happened in 91 was that prior to the adoption of or publishing of plans, that the redistricting committees did indeed have hearings throughout the state in getting public input. The time has passed for that. The Senate has not done that, and seems to me that once the plans are published, that that would be again a service to the people of Minnesota to get their reaction to what it is that we're proposing be passed, that it's going to affect their representation again in Congress and the legislature. And again, this is not subdivision 10. This is not a redistricting principle. And it, in fact, it, it is a just wonder in terms of, and I think this speaks to Senator Gerlach's question as well. Subdivisions 9 and 10 and subdivisions 9 and 10 are vastly different from subdivisions 1 through 8, and perhaps they should have been separated. And we should have, if you're looking at them, the priority of principles, we should have separated that, you know, the first 8 are redistricting principles. Number 9 and 10 are more process issues, and maybe they should have had a different section and a different headnote. So I don't think they're to be construed in the same way, like the data to be used or the consideration of plans. This is a overall, my amendment is more in the process that we use in making a decision. The beginning of subdivision 10 talks about is a prohibition that the plans may not be considered until the block equivalency file showing the district to which each census block has been assigned in a form prescribed by the director of the GIS office has been filed with the director, and then an additional requirement that we get public input.
And so, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, to your knowledge, principle or process, was this part of your principal bill adopted in 2001, this language? That's
Mr.
my question.
Mr. Chairman, and I would have to refer to Mr. Bonnet. I don't believe so, but again, I think some of the things that we're suggesting today are, some of them are going back to 2001, and some of them are, in my mind, are improvements. And this would be in the latter category.
And to Senator Nino's earlier comment, you know, one of the reasons that I feel quite comfortable with the legislature putting together and passing redistricting maps is because we are the branch of government that is designed for public testimony, that is built for openness and transparency and comment. We can't do anything together unless it's taped or recorded. You know, every bit of language you see before you today has been shared with the public. The other thing that I think is different in the year 2011 is technology. I can only guess what it was like to be a part of a redistricting exercise 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. You know, there must have been some people back writing on a desk with some rulers. But just the technology with computers and mapping now and the availability of all that information to the public, I think it is more, again, more open and transparent than ever. And that's as it should be. That's as it should be.
Mr. Chairman,
we're getting a technology update right now. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I am informed that indeed there were legislative hearings around the state by the Senate in 2001, and that the court itself went out 6 different times seeking public comment on plans that were being proposed. So even if it was not in a principal statement, the fact of the matter of practice was no less than what I am proposing here in the A-12. That is that we reach out to the public on the plans themselves.
Further comment on the A-12?
Can I have a roll call?
Yes. Clerk will take the roll on the A-12.
Chair Michelle.
No.
Senator Bach.
Yes.
Senator Gerlach.
No.
Senator Harrington.
Yes.
Senator Koch.
No.
Senator Nino.
No.
Senator Rest.
Yes.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you.
There being three aye and four nay, the A12 is not adopted. Senator Harrington.
And keeping with your last comments, I'd like to offer the A13, which I think is just the A13 in this case, but we'll see. At the last meeting, we talked about the fact that communities of color were specifically interested in this and did not feel like they were engaged in this process up to this point, that they would like to be engaged in this process. And you suggested to me that that was something you were open to, and so I have reached out to them, and they are, in fact, all four councils of color are very interested in having a role in this process and being able to be engaged in this. The A13 amendment is, once again, not part of the principles. It's part of the consideration of plans and fits in on line on page 2, line 18. It asks for four hearings to take place, to take public comment, to be conducted after the release of the preliminary plans, and that the committees should seek the comment on the plan from the Council on Black Minnesotans, the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, Council on Affairs of Chicano Latino People, and the Indian Affairs Council. As I said, following up on your comment at the last meeting, I have reached out to them. They are eager to be engaged in this process, and this would not just facilitate that, but would formalize it.
And Senator Harrington, would you, in your conversations with them, and none of these groups have contacted the committee or committee staff in any formal or informal way at this point, is it your thought that these folks are interested in input prior to draft maps or in response to? There's kind of two different levels of conversation that could happen there.
And I think the answer is both. Mr. Chair, I think that the answer to that is both. They would love to have conversations at both places, but they are, since the timeline, I think, is getting fairly short, I think they recognize that. And so they are prepared to have their comment made after the preliminary maps are done.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Harrington, as chair, I will commit to meeting with anyone at any time. There are no messages in the inbox. There are no invitations that have been declined. I know of no one here waiting to testify further today, and that is certainly the spirit that I will continue to conduct this committee.
Mr. Chairman.
And I guess I'll just finish there, Senator Rest, with I don't think this language would be necessary, and I don't know if, actually, I would venture to say there are probably some groups, task forces, organizations that aren't included that maybe should be if we were going to list them out. I don't know if four hearings is the right number. I think, again, we are the branch that's built for openness and transparency and testimony, and we take it and we welcome it. Senator Rest.
A roll call.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Harrington.
I appreciate, and I'm not sure whether 4 is the number or 8 is the number or 12 is the number or what the number is, these four groups are the groups that have been designated by the state to represent the four largest minority groups or communities of color in the state of Minnesota. And so at a minimum, having these four groups at the table, I think, is respectful of their role in state government as in an advisory sense. They are interested and eager to participate in this process, and so I think recognizing them in this set of principles, it really speaks to the subdivision 6B section, where it talks about not having the intent or effect of dispersing or concentrating minority population. I think it really does facilitate that discussion in a meaningful way, and will both make this process more transparent. It will make it more participative. And as you said, we're the branch of government where public comment is I think probably built into the fabric of what we do. This will formalize that this group is particularly interested in these four, at least these four, and whether you make a decision to expand that number or add other communities or other communities of interest to that, I certainly wouldn't reject that as an amendment to mine. But I think these four groups really do need to be at the table, and this would formalize that.
Clerk will take the roll on the A13.
Chair Michelle.
No.
Senator Bach?
Yes.
Senator Gerlach?
No.
Senator Harrington?
Yes.
Senator Koch?
No.
Senator Nino?
No.
Senator Rest?
Yes.
Senator Senjum?
Thank you. There being 3 aye and 4 nay, the A13 is not adopted. Senator Gerlach.
If I could just say something, Mr. Chairman, real quick to Senator Harrington, because I know that a number, I mean, you are a very good representative of your district and the issues you're bringing forth here, but I know that some of the amendments you've brought forth I hope it's, I guess what I wanted to make sure is that the result of that vote is in no way means that these groups or any other groups are disinvited or there's any kind of a message that they are not involved in or should be involved in the process at all. I hope that's that you would understand that. I think there are some legitimate logistical issues with this about listing other issues. I mean, listing other organizations and groups and such. That this is open to everybody. And I would have expected, maybe hoped that these organizations would have been here today. I'm just surprised that there's not a lot of other individuals here as we're talking about these. But I just wanted to say that I would hope that it's construed in the way that it is a wide open process and they should participate. And I think Senator Michelle is very sincere and very open that anybody can interact with this committee at any time.
And Senator Gerlach, there's not exactly a battle for the microphones here. Senator Harrington.
With all due respect, Senator Gerlach, I think the message that you're not interested in having them listed in these principles speaks for itself. They are interested in doing this. They want to have a part in the process. They are willing to do the setup and facilitate this and to not having in allowed them to even be included in the document to me speaks for itself in some regards. I have, the East Side District of the City of St. Paul has Latino, Hmong, Black, and Native Americans on that in my district. So I think half of my district is made up of people of color, so I do speak passionately on their behalf here. I think when we don't include this, when we say on the one hand, yes, we want the public comment, but we don't have meetings where they're particularly invited before the maps are drawn, and now we're saying we don't think we should particularly invite them once the maps are drawn. I think that really does speak to an unwillingness to have them be part of the process, or at least that it is not as welcoming as it could be. And I would have hoped that we would have welcomed their input with more open arms than the last vote indicates to me.
Mr. Chair, and again going back to 2001, was this a part of the 2001 document, Senator Rest or Council?
Mr. Chairman, as I pointed out earlier, the legislature went all over the state, and the court itself held 6 hearings on it. I don't know that specifically that the state organized and councils of color that are in the state statutes, whether they were constituted as the same now as they were then. I think what is more revealing is that in the A1 amendment there is no indication whatsoever that there will be public comment taken from anyone with regard to the plan that you're putting forward, only that it has to be published on the website.
Senator Nina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Harrington is reading some things in, and I'm not accusing you of anything. I'm just saying you're reading some things in here that, at least in my circumstance, don't exist.
In fact, before I filed this amendment away, I circled a couple of things with some question marks, and I've made some additional notes on here since then. I've spoken to a couple of amendments, and to others I haven't, because I don't feel the need to justify every single vote that I take, and this one I didn't. But for example, the questions that were in mind is, why four hearings? Why not one? Why couldn't we have one hearing all day long, or maybe two hearings? Why four? That's an arbitrary number. Maybe it's right, maybe it's not, but why four? And after, it seems to be, they're not directly tied, but the implication seems to be that we want these groups to have as much input into the process as possible. It seems to me they would want to have input prior to the preliminary plan being released, because afterwards, quite frankly, a large majority of the work has been done. And if Senator Harrington's concern is particularly about getting input from these groups and not about other specifics, maybe Senator Harrington, you just want to offer the last sentence indicating that the committee will seek the input. I mean, the chair has already committed to that anyway.
Mr. Chairman, one last thing is that I think Senator Harrington brings up a very a sincere and real concern. I voted against this because I didn't think it belonged there. We weren't laying out any other groups. But what I would do is I would encourage the chair not to wait for the messages to come in. Don't wait for the phone calls or the messages that, for whatever reason, there seems to be kind of a divide here. And I would strongly encourage the chairman and staff to, it doesn't have to be in the principles here, but please make every effort to reach out to these groups and others through this process and give some level of comfort to those communities and to Senator Harrington, irregardless of whether it fits in the principles or not. I would encourage you to do that.
Senator Harrington.
In response to Senator Nino, as I said before, I'm not married to the number. I'm married to the idea that we're having a transparent and public process where these four groups particularly, and other groups as may come in, have their voice heard in the process. Part of the difficulty, I think, for them, and I can't really speak for them, is I found about the meeting, Wednesday? So it's hard, I think, for them to be able to make that adjustment as quickly as I, who I was going to be here all day anyway. It was easier for me to not be in one committee and be at this committee. I don't know that it is as easy for them. And so building this in, also being respectful of the time constraints that we're under, I said post because I didn't feel like there was going to be enough time for us to set up public meetings in a couple of weeks with all the other things that we had to do. And so post seemed to be respectful of the committee's time and respectful of the Senate's duties that we have in front of us. That they are ready and eager to be here. You set the next meeting up. If you wish to have that, I think we can do that. But I really do think it is important that they have their voice heard here. And I do think it is important whether it's one meeting or four meetings. Now, I will say, having hosted meetings of all of these groups at different times, that to say that you could probably do this all in one meeting, I think is, unless you're talking about an all-day meeting, which I don't know how many of you have an all-day meeting free in your schedule, would be problematic. I think you're going to find the four groups, especially given some of the language issues and some of the transportation issues, four meetings or more than one meeting is probably, from a practical standpoint, what would be necessary. But I am open to the idea that we make certain that this is a transparent process, that the public's voice is heard, and that the communities of color, which are some of the fastest growing segments of Minnesota's population, that their voices should be heard.
And just maybe an observation, members, we've had a mix of topics today, and my hope and my goal is to focus on the principles that will help us to draw fair and good maps. So there are the principles to do the map work. And then I think we've also drifted a bit into process and how we do that in a way that engages the public, takes public testimony at the proper time and the proper venue. And I'm
as a chair, I am very open on all these process issues. I'm not sure that many or any of them belong in the, what is before us, that is the districting principles. And I think that might be one of the kind of dividing points in our in multiple of our conversations today. Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and I think the division that Senator Rest referred to earlier, that you have 1 through 8 are your principles, and then you have 9, 10, and 11, which are your practical, logistical matters, the data to be can use, the consideration of plans, and the priority of principles. Those are where I put this in. I didn't put this into the 1 through 8 in the principles part of this. I very deliberately put it into the practical, how are we going to disseminate this, and what are the steps we're going to use in that review. And so I think I tried to put this into the segment of your bill that where it belongs. I didn't try and put it in as an overriding principle. It seemed to me a practical matter that should be in there with the consideration of plans.
Understood. Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just in terms of the timelines and reaching out to all kinds of people to talk about the principles or proposed principles or plans, I won't particularly comment on the irony of that, but Representative Anderson has indicated that the House Republican plan will be out on Tuesday. And end of statement.
Are there further amendments to the A1, which is now Senate file 1317?
I have one more.
Senator Harrington.
The A14 amendment? Willing to go two.
Does everyone have the A14?
No.
Roll call, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Harrington to the A14.
And this kind of just is, this follows up, Mr. Chair, to my original comments about transparency and making sure that people have time to see the plan and to have some input into it. I would be willing to have an author's amendment, which in light of our timelines now with the end of session, would reduce this to a period of 2 weeks. But I really think people need a chance to be able to review this, to formulate their response, and to give us feedback on that. And so this language would require us to hold off on our votes on this until after it has been posted and available to the public for comment and testimony. As I said, I would be willing to change that number down to 2 weeks, because I think 2 weeks might be, given the timelines of our session, a more practical number. But ideally, I think 4 weeks is for this much information, for the amount of detail that's going to go into this, and the importance of this in terms of the future of congressional and legislative districts. I think in an ideal world, I would still want 4 weeks, but I'm more than willing to work within the confines of our timelines and constraints now, and make an author's amendment to say this would be 2 weeks.
Mr. Chairman? Just incorporate the change.
Senator Harrington, working with Mr. Bonner, do you want to insert 2 weeks instead of four, and just
yes, I would.
Just offer it that way. Yeah.
All right, so line 1.6 will read 2 weeks. And I appreciate the spirit it's offered, Senator Harrington. A lot of this calendar is beyond our control. We didn't even get the census data information until a month ago, until March. So you couldn't do anything but kind of
speculate and be hypothetical until March. The Constitution doesn't allow us to meet after May 23rd. As Senator Bach reminded us yesterday, we got a little work to do on the budget still. And I guess the other timeline that we cannot control is in state law, it requires us to have, if we're not done, I'm going to forget the exact date, but mid-February of next year, the courts automatically take it over. So that's kind of the cards we've been dealt. Again, I think this gets to, and I think this gets to process and public testimony, and I appreciate the spirit it's going. I'd be surprised if whether it's 4 weeks as originally drafted or 2 weeks, if Senator Rest, if that was the process that was used before, but be that as it may, I appreciate the spirit. I'll oppose the amendment.
Senator Rest. Mr. Chairman, believe that Tuesday is May 2nd. The 14th to that is May 16th. That's another whole week before we have a constitutional requirement to adjourn to hear from the public about preliminary plans. Seems to me it is not only a courtesy but an obligation to make sure that the public and the legislature knows that the plans that are out there, and they are not something that is just going to be done without seeking them. You indicated that we've only had the data since March, but Representative Anderson has said that the House Republican plan is going to be out on Tuesday, so they've been obviously working quite hard. So I think that this is a very reasonable amendment that indeed does speak to the validity of the process and the transparency, and it should not be a partisan issue.
Mr. Chair, just one addition, and appreciate Senator Rest's comments. And this may be a good idea; it may or may not, and it may or may not work within the time frame. I'd like to allow some flexibility. It might be 2 weeks. It might be 3 weeks. Well, 3 weeks would put us over the date, but I would argue for allowing some flexibility, and instead of putting this in our document and putting those constraints on this committee.
Senator Nino.
Well, Mr. Chair, we get into some of the same questions I had before, 2 weeks. So if we got into a time frame crunch and we passed 13, if this were required, 13 days was all we had left. We couldn't do that and comply with our own requirement here. And the question I ask is 13 days too few? And I ask that rhetorically, but if someone wants to answer, you know, is 13 days not enough?
Well, you raise a good point, Senator Nino, and we also have, there's another actor in this exercise, and that would be the governor. And until the end of session, he gets 3 days to sign or reject bills that are put before him. So there's a couple of moving pieces here. I appreciate Senator Koch's thought that might be best to have some flexibility. It's going to be a busy May. There's no doubt about it.
And Mr. Chair, that's my point. You know, if 14 days is enough, 13 isn't. If 13 days is enough, 12 isn't. You know, I think if we were to have a plan in front of us and vote on it 10 minutes later, that would clearly be out of bounds. But at some point, there's been enough time, and where exactly is that? And maybe 2 weeks is it, maybe 13 days is it.
Again, I like this, Senator Nina. I like some of these ideas for a budget.
Sure.
You know, requiring us to get more input, to seek more input. We've had a lot of things come on the desk at 3 a.m. That's not good. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of the issue of flexibility, if you read the language at the end of line 5 and 6, it does say at least 2 weeks. So if you think you need more than that, you have the flexibility of doing it, but at least would give comfort to the public to know that they would have 2 weeks, if not more, to comment on the plans that legislature presents.
Mr. Chair, that was precisely my point in going the other direction. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll ask, you can answer or not, Senator Rest, but is 13 days not enough?
I think there's flexibility, as I indicated, if you were asking for, in saying that there should be at least 2 weeks. I mean, we do deal in timelines, Senator Nino.
Mr. Chair, and I just would highlight that there is not, in this language, there is not flexibility for 13 days.
Thank you, members. So to the A14.
Roll call.
Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Michelle.
No.
Senator Bach.
Yes.
Senator Gerlach.
No.
Senator Harrington.
Yes.
Senator Koch.
No.
Senator Nino.
No.
Senator Rest.
Yes.
Senator Sendrum.
Being 3 aye and 4 nay, the A14 is not adopted. Further discussion, members? If not, then I would move that Senate file 1317 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the full Rules Committee.
Roll call.
Clerk will take the roll on the Senate file 1317 as amended.
Chair Michelle.
Yes, aye.
Senator Bach.
No.
Senator Gerlach.
Yes.
Senator Harrington.
No.
Senator Koch.
Yes.
Senator Nino.
Yes.
Senator Rest.
No.
Senator Sengem.
Okay, thank you, members. Senate file 1317 is being 4 aye and 3 nay is recommended to pass and refer to the full Rules Committee. Members, I do want to take up the concurrent resolution, which is nearly identical, Mr. Bodern, to the A1. So it's Senate concurrent resolution number 7. You want to quickly highlight anything that you would you suggest we haven't covered?
Chairman, is it your intent that the language be identical?
Why don't we have Mr. Bodern speak to that? There is one
difference that you want to maintain. Okay.
Mr. Bodern.
So, Mr. Chairman, one difference I will highlight for you, and I believe it is your intention that the committee work from the A1 amendment to the concurrent resolution.
Thank you.
If you look at that amendment, you'll see.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I don't seem to have my copy of that. If I could have a copy of the.
I think it's right there.
Is it this one?
That's it.
Mr. Bonner.
The concurrent resolution or the joint resolution? Is that what you're talking about?
I'm looking at the A1 of the concurrent resolutions and the rest.
Mr. Chairman, with regard to that, once again, I...
Mr. Bowden will highlight that.
I object to considering the Senate concurrent resolution on the basis of Senate rules. Go ahead.
Mr. Bonner.
Mr. Chairman, so the difference between the concurrent resolution and the Senate File 1317 is, of course, the language in the resolution is uncodified, and it is also temporary, of course. It would not require the approval of the governor. And the differences, the specific differences in language, can be found on 1.5 to 1.6 of the A1 amendment. There is a reference there to the number of members in each body. That is established in law. The resolution contains this, I think, simply because it's in this form and not amending the statutes where that number already appears. There is a difference also in the expiration provided for the resolution on the reverse on line 2.23 is the same. However, the effective date is not contained there. It is assumed the resolution would apply as soon as, if it were passed by the Senate, it would apply to the Senate's redistricting process. The effective date in Senate File 1317 would apply that those principles to any redistricting process.
Anything else you want to highlight, Senator Mr. Bodden?
Mr. Chairman, that's it. I'm going to take a moment to review a couple of things. I'll let you know if I find something else that.
Thank you. So, Senator Rest, based upon some of our earlier conversations in this committee, I wanted to forward to the full Rules Committee both a concurrent resolution and something in statutory form as options to consider.
And Mr. Chairman, as I indicated, that was not an issue of substance. It was an issue of process and the rules. I would point out that I would encourage the members to vote no on the basis of process, but on the basis of the substance, that it be understood that the amendments that have been offered by Senator Bach, Senator Harrington, and myself would also be offered irrespective of the process issue to this document, but based on the votes on those amendments, we will not be offering them to this document.
Thank you, Senator Rest. So, members, then I would move the.
And I would ask for a roll call.
Senator Rest, so let's ask for a roll call. So I'd move the A1 to Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 7. Clerk will take the roll on the A1.
Chair Michelle.
Yes.
Senator Bach.
Oh.
Senator Gerlach.
Yes.
Senator Harrington.
No.
Senator Koch.
Yes.
Senator Nino.
Yes.
Senator Rest.
No.
Senator Senjum.
All right, members, there being 4 aye and 3 nay, the A1 is adopted. And I would move that Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 7, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full Rules Committee.
Roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Clerk will take the roll on Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 7, as amended.
Chair Michelle.
Yes.
Senator Bach. Senator Gerlach.
Yes.
Senator Harrington.
No.
Senator Koch.
Yes.
Senator Nino.
Yes.
Senator Rest.
No.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, members, and thank you, staff. There being 4 aye and 3 nay, Senate Concurrent Resolution is passed and referred to the Rules Committee.
Senators Roebling and Olson, there may be some others, apologize. I know you guys are trying to take over this room. Members, there being no further business at this time, committee is adjourned.